So, yeah, we're about, we're kind of in the middle of Revelation, or in the second half. And what I've noticed is that as I read through these chapters, you know, it may not make complete sense initially or ever, but a lot of the things, you know, I don't have to go, you know, read a whole lot of things to at least get a general idea of what is going on. So John isn't introducing brand new symbols anymore. He's bringing in images, words, symbols that he has already used. And when we are consistent in reading the book of Revelation, a lot of things begin to fall into place and to make sense. So we're in Revelation 17. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read through the text of this chapter first. And then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, 'Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come, and when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. They are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth."
Good heavens.
The seven angels with the seven bowls of God's wrath had poured out all their bowls in the previous chapter. Now one of the seven angels who had poured out the wrath comes to John and speaks to him. "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters." Now, in our reading, we notice that John is actually not shown the judgment in this chapter. That's the next chapter. But what John is shown is the description of Babylon, the woman. And I think that I see this as an expansion of the description of Babylon that we first saw in the second angel's message in Revelation chapter 14. In that section, it was one verse, it was very short. But now, this description is being expanded. We should first note that the prostitute is seen seated on many waters. Well, what is many waters? We don't know yet. The actual identification is going to be found at the end of the chapter. Why is this woman called a prostitute? Well, the reason is found in the next verse, because she promotes sexual immorality. And what have we identified sexual immorality in Revelation?
Other gods.
True. Worshipping other gods. It's part of it. It's broader than that, though. It is accommodating the systems of buying into worldly principles. And the reason for that, the reason for this, for idolatry and buying into the systems of the world, the temptation for the recipients of Revelation was that they could somehow gain security. See, it has to do with fear. Your fear has to be resolved somehow.
Like, if I don't do this, how will I provide for my family? You know,
right.
I have to do this. I have to compromise my beliefs in order to provide for my family.
For resources for daily living, or maybe in some of these cities it may have been for life itself. Now, how can I guarantee myself today and tomorrow? And the obvious and easy answer is, buy into the imperial cult. Then all your problems will go away. It's the promise.
People will stop bothering you.
Yeah.
You'll be accepted. So the many waters is the systems of the world?
Many nations of the world bought into the system.
Yeah, at the end, the text will identify what many waters means. So it's called a prostitute because she promotes sexual immorality. And sexual immorality is not literal sexual immorality in the book of Revelation. It is the mingling of bringing in of worldly systems of security.
And the way I keep
it. Unfaithfulness? Basically unfaithfulness?
Yeah, not trusting that God can take care of you.
Go back to Mount Carmel, which was the issue at bay is fear or trust. So I take exactly back to Carmel, and when you say prostitutes, it's back to systems of fear versus systems of trust.
So prostitute itself is a new character, but is she something completely different, or is this character another view of something we've already encountered? And the answer is probably it's another perspective on what we've already seen in the past in Revelation. And finally, looking ahead, Revelation 21 depicts another one of the seven angels who had poured out one of the seven bowls, showing a city. And this city is going to be the New Jerusalem. The point of this is that Revelation 17 and Revelation 21 are parallel chapters. And so this prostitute probably represents some kind of a city imagery symbol. Okay, verse 2. With whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. Kings of the earth. In the very beginning of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 5, it was declare that Jesus is the true ruler above all kings. He's the King of Kings. However, these kings of the earth, they call upon the rocks to fall on them. This is in seal number 6 in chapter 6. And we also have kings of the east and the kings of the world coming together for, you know, to battle at Armageddon. That was last time in chapter 16. So these kings represent some kind of power or, you know, figures, entities that influence people. Sexual immorality itself was mentioned in the letter to Pergamum in regards to Balaam and Balak, where Balaam, you know, said to tempt Israel. It was also mentioned in the letter to Thyatira in relation to Jezebel. It was also mentioned in relation to trumpet 6 as a characteristic of those who won't repent. And sexual immorality is the accusation that the second angel makes against Babylon the Great. The imagery of city as a harlot, as a prostitute, is found in the Old Testament in Isaiah 1:21, where Jerusalem is accused as a harlot. In Isaiah 23, Tyre, the city of Tyre, is accused as a harlot. And in Nahum chapter 3, Nineveh is accused as a harlot.
Because they've all been unfaithful.
Because they've been all, right, unfaithful. They have perverted God's justice. And, you know, God's justice, primarily in the Bible and Scripture, is not about, you know, giving what a person deserves, but it's about doing, right? It can be seen as a negative thing or a positive thing. And the Bible, when it speaks of God's justice, it is primarily about God doing the right thing.
Not about vindication.
Right. Not about vengeance.
The just is a different concept. The just, so to speak.
The idea of an entity being drunk with blood comes from Ezekiel 39:19. The wine representing immorality comes from the second angel in Revelation 14:8. We've already talked numerous times about the identification of dwellers on earth. Well, again, as a reminder, it means they are not God's servants. In other words, those with the mark of the beast, those who do not repent, and they are the recipients of judgment. Finally, destruction of Babylon is the imagery and language that's found in Revelation 17 and 18 come from Jeremiah chapter 51. We're not going to take time today to go through it. If we had a little more time, we would.
There's been a lot of Jeremiah.
Jeremiah and Isaiah are favorite allusions. Ezekiel, those major prophets.
He's gone back to them a lot and told.
Yeah, because they are the ones that were, you know, proclaimed God's judgment on all, basically all the major cities, nations, at their times. And and so, in some way, you know, John is saying in Revelation that same thing's being proclaimed. You know, the world is under judgment. The only people who are only peoples who are safe are those who trust in God. Verse 3, and he carried me away into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and had 7 heads and 10 horns. Carried away is similar to Ezekiel's experiences, where in about 5-6 different places he speaks of being carried away in the spirit to receive some kind of vision from God. That's what's happening with John. Now, we saw the wilderness and the woman. These words were encountered in Revelation chapter 12, speaking of the church. and how the woman fled, the woman fled to the wilderness, and so is the prostitute of Revelation 17 the same or the corrupted version of the woman or the church in Revelation chapter 12?
The woman in Revelation 12 who was protected by God and all that?
Mm-hmm. I had the same question. What's the prostitute or the scarlet doing in the wilderness?
It's a very good question, isn't it?
But isn't it in the next verse that, or a couple of verses down, where he says that the beast and the woman will facilitate the ending of the king?
Yeah. No, the kings will end the woman.
That's right. What's odd here, and I've been waiting for you to get there, is the kings were prosecuting the prostitutes.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. But it's just an important point here, because in some interpretations of prophecy, the woman always represents some kind of a church.
Mm-hmm. So the kings are going to turn against their own belief.
But what's important is to recognize the parallel between Revelation 21, the New Jerusalem identified as a woman, and Revelation 17, Babylon identified as a woman. In these chapters, it is not the church of any kind that is the woman.
When you say woman, are you saying prostitute?
Yeah.
Okay, so the prostitute is not a false church?
Not exclusively. It can, but it's broader than that.
So, including the church, but maybe even more than that. So you're saying...
This has been used. Uh-huh. What I'm getting at,
yeah.
What I've been kind of dancing around, is this has been used in the past by certain interpreters to say that Babylon is the Roman Catholic Church.
Right, right. Uh-huh.
That's not what it's saying.
Maybe
well, it seems like
maybe false churches could participate in what is Babylon, but maybe it wouldn't be specifically just that particular church, etc.
And going down a few verses, it speaks of Babylon the Great being the mother of prostitutes, which means that she must have children.
Uh-huh.
And her children are all the other apostate churches.
Right, right.
That is,
except for
this chapter, when read
that
in the context of the entirety of Revelation, it would be hard to support that interpretation.
Okay.
Hard to support the proliferation of churches?
Hard to support the interpretation that the prostitute is the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And that her children, by implication, are all apostate churches.
Apostate churches is what is...
In other words,
superficial would be that the prostitute would be the Roman Catholic Church, and the little ones would all be the Protestant churches.
And all the Protestant churches are her children.
Children.
Except for the one that's actually
okay,
right.
Okay, yeah. So we're yeah.
Okay, but I think I'm reading in here that historically I thought we've always had the right and the wrong, the good and the bad, but now we've got a third player in here, because the kings actually are fighting the prostitutes. So you got the good, the kings, and the prostitute. It's not two anymore, it's three.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Just hold it.
We have to really scrub our brains to get it in right, Mark.
The reason is, again, the parallel between chapter 12 and chapter 17 and chapter 21, it's speaking about a city. It's not talking about a church.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Revelation 12 is clearly talking about church as God's people.
Uh-huh.
Another reason.
So we should draw a parallel more between 17 and 21 than between 12 and 17.
Correct.
Okay.
So 12, where it says the woman fled and was nourished, that seems like a good thing.
That is a good thing. And it's,
and the woman is a good thing.
And there is no end to that. See, the woman fleeing to the wilderness and being nourished is an allusion to Elijah's experience during the drought.
The woman always remains good.
That's another point. The woman, the definite article, the, is used in chapter 12. In chapter 17, it's actually a woman. It's an indefinite article.
But woman is always pure, is always good. Prostitute is not. Woman is.
Mm-hmm. And in verse 3 it reads, and I saw a woman. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say I saw the woman. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's getting too nitpicky, but maybe it can be important. There's no nourishing motif in chapter 17 unless one takes the idea of getting drunk as such. Maybe that's stretching it. Things a bit.
Drunk
so
usually tends to make more looseness, not more deceit.
And finally, the idea of wilderness comes not from chapter 12, even though the same word is used. It's not from chapter 12, but it comes from Isaiah 21, which speaks of Babylon as a wilderness in the sea. In chapter 12, the woman fled into the wilderness. In chapter 17, a woman, representing prostitute as Babylon, is wilderness of the sea.
So that's the safe place of the dwellers of the earth.
So that's where the many imagery of many waters can also come in.
Wilderness of the sea.
Did the good woman, the pure woman, go to the wilderness of the sea or the wilderness of land?
Just went to the wilderness.
So is it the same wilderness?
And both the land and the sea came and helped the woman. Woman is now, notice, sitting on the beast. Just two verses earlier, the woman was...
Is this a woman or the woman?
A woman,
but now the weird... When I say the, I mean...
Church.
The woman, no, not the church, the woman of chapter 17 now.
The woman that we're talking about now.
It's...
Better just keep saying a woman.
A woman, prostitute. So, just two verses earlier,
the woman of chapter
this woman, the prostitute, was sitting on many waters. So, the point here is imagery is fluid. This continues the highly symbolic nature of the book. She can be sitting in one instance on many waters. In the next moment, she can be sitting on a beast. So, this is another warning that we should not assume an allegorical one-to-one correspondence between imagery and something in reality. The beast is described with blasphemous names, seven heads and ten horns. This is the exact description of the first beast in Revelation 13. So this scarlet beast is the first beast. And back when we were discussing that, we identified the first beast as the imperial cult. The emperor worship.
Could it be applied to various sorts of false worship, worshiping something other than God?
Oh, it could be that, but that would be an application.
Right, an application in our day. And in the setting in which it was written, the worshiping the emperor would be the false worship that it is applied to here.
So, yeah, the imperial cult. So, we had the dragon, the first beast, and the second beast. The dragon is the devil, Satan, the primary instigator of the war against the saints. The first beast prosecutes the war on behalf of the dragon. The first beast is the imperial cult. The second beast promotes the worship of the first beast. In other words, the second beast are all those entities that support the first beast, that support the imperial worship.
Which one?
Imperial cult. The guilds, trade guilds, the various religions. the local government?
Society. All of society was supporting.
Yeah. Was Rome a singular country or was it a conglomerate?
Yes and no. It was an empire. There, it afforded various degrees of autonomy based on how a region came into the empire.
So those sub-countries could also be supporting the cult.
True. Okay, so the woman, verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and impurities of sexual immorality. This adornment echoes language that's found in Ezekiel 28, where Ezekiel describes the king of Tyre. Purple and scarlet are symbols of wealth and power. John is indicting wealth and power here, what it represents. And again, sexual immorality we discussed, but it has to do with accommodating and compromising to obtain the wealth and power, comfort and security that the, quote, world system claims to control and to offer to people who, quote, worship it. Verse 5, and on her forehead was written, a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. Babylon the Great was mentioned by the second angel in chapter 14, verse 8. Forehead is the place of marking, whether it's of God's seal or the mark of the beast. The forehead is one of the places where people are marked, identified as to where they belong. The mystery, what is mystery? Well, there was mystery of seven stars in chapter 1. There was a mystery of God that was mentioned in chapter 10. So mystery is something that is couched in symbols, something that is spoken of using symbols. The mother is referenced back to the letter to the church in Thyatira and of Jezebel. In that letter, Jezebel was said to teach and lead people astray through immorality and idolatry. Jezebel is referred to as a prophetess in chapter 2, verse 20. So we can see that this woman in chapter 17, the prostitute, could be another representation of the second beast, the false prophet of chapter 16. So this is another reason to reject the interpretation that this woman is a corruption of the woman of chapter 12. The historical Jezebel could be considered the mother of Baal worship in Israel during Elijah's time. She was the one who brought in from the region of Sidon. That's where she's from. Baal worship into the northern kingdom of Israel. Until that time, Israel, although they were not worshiping at Jerusalem and they were worshiping images, they were worshiping images that they claimed represented the God of Israel. So even though it was corrupted, it was still a worship of the God of Israel. Now when Jezebel comes in, there's no more pretense that they're worshiping the God of Israel.
They're no longer trying to worship.
Correct. And she had many false prophets, you could say children, under her command. Jezebel, the historic Jezebel.
Okay. What's Atha?
Okay. Also known as. six. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Drunk with the blood of saints is mentioned in chapter 14, 8, part of the second angel's message. It's the reason in 16:6, reason for the bulls and the judgment. But they have oppressed God's people. Martyred saints, we encountered some of those, specifically Antipas was mentioned in the letter to Pergamum in chapter 2. We've also seen that as souls under the altar in chapter 6. The two witnesses were also martyred in chapter 11. Bloodshed sporting events historically kept the Roman populace entertained and happy. being drunk with the blood of other people is a literal, was a little literal reality at that time, and perhaps it is a literal reality today as well. It's speaking to the violence.
Like computer games. I mean, certain computer games are violent.
It was a, yeah, Rome was a culture that gloried in its violent power.
That it had the power to kill.
Yeah, violence was its solution to all of its problems.
Revenge.
Just to be a rogue that I am, in today's society, our sports are extremely aggressive, and the object is to win over the other person. And if I were to get on my high horse and preach against sports, I'd be about as popular as Revelation was.
Probably. Yeah, speak out against football games.
Mm-hmm. About people punching each other with their heads in their stomachs.
Yeah,
good luck. And our society would be blind to that, because in actuality, as a young person, I thought that they were violent and wrong. As I've grown older, I have seen that in actuality, historically, I think that's where young people learn how to be managers of groups of people and businesses. And it was the proving ground of those who have the fortitude to lead companies. I don't know if it's true or not today, but I think that was a viable building stone. Is it good or bad?
You know, I used to think of wrestling as really awful, but then I've heard mothers of kids that are in wrestling, and it's a real discipline. You know, these aren't wimps out there that are doing these things. They're athletes.
Yeah, the kind of wrestling that's done in this competition in schools is not about violence.
It's athletic.
Yeah. Now there's the so-called pro wrestling, which is, you know, theater. It's violent theater.
Well, so most of all martial arts forms, they're all usually
a discipline.
A dance between two people that are capable at that art form.
Yeah, and
to contest each other.
Those who would use those skills against another person to take advantage of them would be considered rogue by most of these martial arts.
Jiu-jitsu is the only one that's like way scary and all about just flat out hurt. They don't teach it as a discipline, they don't teach it as a art form, they teach it simply to show you how to hurt.
But I think Rome, one thing that Rome had in common with a lot of countries today, a lot of people in a lot of countries focus on the country's ability to beat up all the other countries around them, ability to be superior.
Through strength.
Yes, through force. And
you know, which is why the whole point of Revelation is the world's way is that of power, violence, threats, deceit, coercion,
yeah,
manipulation.
Vast. We do not understand or see another way, and by and large, we buy into that system in our own lives, in our own community, in our own churches. We are human. We can't see the other side.
The call to the saints is to be faithful, to endure. You know a better way. You know the way that works.
Live above it.
Yeah. You know what doesn't work, you know what works. The way that works doesn't seem to, may not appear to work, but still,
it's foolish.
Keep faithful.
It's foolish to the systems of the world.
So, continuing, when I saw her, I marveled greatly, but the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her." So marvel means to wonder, to admire, to be in astonishment, to be in awe. And we can, there's, like to refer back to chapter 13, verse 4, the latter half, where the people asked, "Who is like the beast and who can fight against it?" The beast appears all powerful. The beast is awesome.
Just like the system.
John is awed by the beast.
And the beast is
it's marvelous.
The biggest and the best.
So
everybody will bow.
What I see in what John experiences and what the angel is saying is there is a sense of deception that is being cast through awe and power. In other words, awe and power, or the fear that it generates, can short-circuit reason.
Yeah. When you see something or someone that portrays themselves as all-powerful and glorious and bigger than everybody else and will take all comers, the natural...
Yeah,
response is to say, "Wow, that's amazing."
If someone or some organization tells you that, you know, "I can guarantee you safety and security in life," mm-hmm. How tempting, you know, if you'll just, you know, checklist of a number of things that you have to do, say, comply.
I think they do it. John in his imagery is saying also that throughout his imagery, he's using the multitude or the sea of people.
Mass.
He's using the mass, the grandeur of the group that is against you, that inspires you to feel insignificant against it. And that's what's really upon us in any form of the systems of the world, is that the massive group that is against you is overwhelming in its own right. The awestruck imagery is that you might see this person on top of the beast, the woman. That's you if you're willing to ride it. And that's the small part of it. The large part is everything else underneath it, is the magnitude of the pressure that's upon you to do what that wants you to do.
And it takes you for a ride.
Yeah.
But you subscribe to it by sitting on it.
Yeah. So here the angel says, I will tell you the mystery. Mysteries were very common in the ancient world. Pagan mysteries are knowledge that was hidden from the general public and made only available to a select few. Biblical mysteries are puzzles whose meanings are revealed by God. And Daniel chapter 2 claims God to be the revealer of mysteries. So for Christians, those who follow God, servants of God, there are no mysteries. Verse 8, "The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction, and the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come."
Okay, what does that mean?
So the phrase "was and is not and is about to rise or is to come" is a parallel to "who was and is to come." "Who was and is to come" is always a reference to God.
Uh-huh. Is it also a parallel to the resurrection?
It's who...
I thought it was referring to the beast.
He did also.
Well, the reference to the beast is was and is not and is about to rise. Or and is to come.
Like a counterfeit.
The beast is a grotesque parody, a counterfeit of God. This idea that and is not is also a reference to the mortal wound that was healed in 13:3.
And what was that?
In 13:3, this beast received a mortal wound, and the nations marveled when the beast came back. He was healed and came back.
Yeah, and what was that? I don't remember. What we decided.
Oh, at that point in time, well, the common rumor was that Nero, who had
would return.
Yeah, who had died, would return.
Got it.
So it was a return of a resurrection of an emperor.
Kind of like stories you would tell your children, be good or Nero will come back and get you kind of thing.
Yeah, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, mortal wound that was healed.
Ah. Well, it's kind of like all of our little things where you didn't find the body type deal. Supposedly Hitler could still be alive, or Osama bin Laden wasn't found because it was a conspiracy that Obama just wanted to get back in office. You know, these things.
Yeah, so the phrases are slightly different. Was and is not and is to come. Versus who was and is and is to come. The key difference between the beast and God is the phrase is not versus is. God always is. The beast, there was a period when is it is not. So it is not eternal. The bottomless pit was mentioned first in trumpet number 5. It was also mentioned in reference to the beast that kills the two witnesses. And so the beast of Revelation 11 can be said to be the same first beast of Revelation 13. This.
So getting away from words, are we basically talking about worship, what do you call
powers?
It? No. Emperor worship.
Mm-hmm.
So emperor worship was, emperor worship wasn't, emperor worship will come back. Or emperor worship power, or that system of government was...
Where you worship the governor?
Well, it's a whole system of power. What's odd to me, and it really explains it, is that Nero was insane, and a lot of people didn't like him, and he was tremendously in power. And then he wasn't in power. Why in the world did the people allow him to come back in? Because he still had his fingers in his eyes, and he was a mafia. You can't get rid of the mafia by getting rid of one person. He's a very... Is that what we're talking about? And I totally screwed up again.
Maybe taking it further than it is intended.
Okay.
I think the main point here is that the beast is a counterfeit that is seeking worship, when only God is truly eternal and deserves worship.
And the emperor seeking to be worshipped is part of the beast, but the beast is not specifically just this one system. The beast can be broader than that?
The beast is much broader.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, yeah, so continuing on here.
Emperor worship is part of the beast.
This beast, it is said, will go to destruction. And destruction is, in Greek, is apaleia. In the fifth trumpet, the king of the locusts, the angel of the bottomless pit, his name was identified as Apollyon, meaning destroyer. So there's a relation between the go to destruction and Apollyon, the name destroyer. What John is saying is that the destroyer himself will be destroyed. Destruction will be destroyed. Dwellers on Earth, we've already talked about that. The Book of Life, we've identified early on as this is probably the scroll with the seven seals. It's comes back again. The dwellers on earth, they marvel against, you know, like John's experience upon seeing the beast. But in this instance, the dwellers on earth fall to the deception of awe and power. They follow after the beast and worship it. We go back to chapter 13. So 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads and seven mountains on which the woman is seated. This calls for, it's the third occurrence of this type of phrase. The first was, here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. The second was, this calls for wisdom. Let the one who is understanding calculate the number of the beast. Mm-hmm. So it's something that, you know, it's a call for the saints, for the servants of God to recognize something that's going on. Notice that the woman is now described as seated on seven mountains. Earlier, she was seated on many waters, and then on a scarlet beast. Now she's on seven mountains. Again, the symbolism is very fluid. It moves. Seven mountains. What does it mean? Well, contemporary Rome was described as sitting on seven hills. In this passage, hills have become mountains, and prophetic language frequently employs hyperbole or exaggeration. Again, it's a reminder to be careful with literalism when reading prophetic texts.
So Rome, at the time this was written, was on seven hills.
Was described as being on seven hills.
That's pervasive. Hasn't Rome always been known as the city of seven hills?
Probably. So
it's nothing unique.
So I guess the point here is not to make that mean more than anything, more than what people then would have heard.
You say it's not a mountain, but it's an exaggeration. Mm-hmm.
That's wrong.
You know, ask a Jerry question. Really quick. No, it's just kind of off topic a little bit, but so they say that call for a time to be wise goes to calculate the number of weeks. Is that where the term "I've got your number" came from?
I have no idea.
It just kind of came to mind, like, I got your number, you know? And so is that like kind of a correlation?
I think that's more related to I know what pushes your buttons.
Okay.
Yeah. So we are getting short on time here. So verse 10, they are also, these heads, seven heads are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only for a little while. Seven heads are also seven kings. You know, they were mountains earlier, but now they're kings. The seven kings, five have fallen, this is the who was, one is, this is the one who is, the other has not yet come, is to come. It's another reflection and parody upon God. Kings, what do they represent power and authority. These kings represent the power and authority of Rome. And recall that according to contemporary legend, Nero was expected to return. There is no consensus on the precise identity of the seven kings. There have been many numberings of Roman emperors trying to identify, okay, so who's the first five, and what's the sixth, and what's the seventh? And there is no consensus, there is none that fit perfectly. So it is perhaps it is best to see these kings as representing the totality of Rome's reign on the earth, because seven is a symbol for completeness. What it means is that Christians are living 6/7 of the way through history. Not to be taken literally, but rather that we are in, Christians at that time are being told they are living in that almost time. The final king is just around the corner. A little while, possibly related to the short time of rejoicing that those who dwell on earth have over the two dead witnesses. So, he must remain only a little while. In chapter 11, the two witnesses were killed, and the people rejoiced in the cities over their dead bodies for a short period before God returns. And perhaps it is also related to the time the dragon has. His time is short. This is chapter 12, verse 12. Again, this is just encouragement for the Christians to remain faithful, to endure, to recognize the temptation to buy into the world's systems of power and authority, and the assurance that the end is near. Verse 11, as for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but belongs to the seventh, and it goes to destruction. Was and is not. It's the same beast as one that was described in verse 8. An eighth, but belongs to the seven. So it's distinct from the seven kings, but it's of the same nature. That's what it means.
Right. The historic classic Adventist interpretation of this is Rome, and then the Pope, and then Napoleon putting him on, and then coming back to power again. That's modern day interpretation. Is there any validity? That's a loaded question. Where do you go on that?
Strictly from the reading here, it's a possible application, and that's not to say the application is wrong, but that's certainly not what John would have had in mind.
That's correct. John didn't have that in mind, but we have interpreted to mean all this stuff. Does it fit, or have we stretched it so far that it's actually absurd?
But depending on what time you live in, you can make it fit the events of your time. And is that wrong? I don't know that that's wrong to see in this story the events of your time. But to try and tell another set of people, you have to see
in this story
what I see.
Interpreting past events in light of biblical prophecy is much safer than trying to predict the future based on biblical prophecy.
But, Mike, I think it fits very well.
Yeah.
But what I don't know is if it's appropriate or is it just a coincidence.
As in, did God arrange it to happen in that sequence in coordination with this, or did God have John describe it in this way, knowing ahead of time what Nero was going to do? I don't know if we can really say.
Well, what you can say is, has it been stretched so thin that isn't realistic, or has it been stretched inappropriately?
One specific metaphor, maybe not. But the whole thing...
If a particular doctrine requires that interpretation, then it is on dangerous ground.
In other words, it can't be used as a cornerstone.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's all in the future.
No.
No.
No, this is Napoleon put the Pope on an island and... That's where he is not. And then he came back for 3 years. And
that is, John certainly would not have
understood
that. No. So it's. I think what's important is that. In my reading, this eighth. It's an eighth, but belongs to the seven. Is very distinct from the kings. In other words, we should not assume a chronological order. That the eighth must follow the seven. In fact, this eighth could be concurrent with any or all of the seven. Eighth, at the time of the writing of Revelation, the eighth day was becoming associated with the day of Jesus' resurrection. So it's Sunday, the day of resurrection, rather than being the first day, was being talked about as the eighth day.
Interesting.
7 day week, but the eighth is always the weekend. It ends on the eighth day.
It's an allusion to the resurrection.
Uh-huh. After everything is finished, something new comes.
And more
I know that
perfect.
Revelations is being written, pardon me, Lord, as something that the churches are supposed to read as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But everything else in the Bible speaks as though. Our changes toward God are done individually, and these accounts of like cheer or like you know, keeping Christians going, encouragement is more. It's being done on a, you have to do it in the church, but on a personal level. So, not seeking the systems of the world is something that you're going to have to do in Revelation personally before you can come to a church and do it as a group. And I understand doing it as a group, but I think the misinterpretations of wanting to see the future through it is because people haven't done the work individually to come to that group and understand it together. And that's what I think is really the baseline that's for me here as I'm reading this and understanding that these are things that I need to take to me first. I need to take that ability to not be pulled into a fear-based religion, to not be pulled into the awe structure that I can't be bigger than the world that's around me through God, and then come to a community of people that believe that together with me for the strength that we can commune for God together. Anyway, that's what I keep reading here, is that it's an encouragement for Christians, but you have to take that encouragement individually before you can do it as a church. I know you keep saying it's not an individual thing, but it just seems like you have to do it that way.
So we talked about the seven heads. The ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, for they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. Ten horns, the ten kings, is a reference to Daniel chapter 7:24, the vision of the four beasts, and the fourth beast has these ten horns. The numbers so far have been highly symbolic, in other words, not necessarily literal thus far, so no reason to insist in a literal ten here. It may be, it may be not. Shouldn't base
it means a lot.
Beliefs on that ten. Have not received power. In other words, their activity still lies in some future time from where John is writing. It may be another way of looking at the gathering of the kings of bowl number six. Remember, in bowl number six, the frogs or demons went out to gather the kings of the earth together for Armageddon. And so maybe it's part of that, with gathering together of the kings. 1 hour is a very, very short period. It's the shortest period that we've seen so far. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. So these kings, the seven kings, the eight, the ten kings, the kings and the beast act in concert with singular purpose. Side note. This is a verse that is sometimes or maybe often used to support a doctrine of absolute national sovereignty, using the interpretation that kings are literal heads of states of nations.
But they're pictured handing over their power and authority to the devil, basically. Doesn't seem like absolute national sovereignty is represented here.
Yeah. The kings are not literal heads of state, but they are PR agents, public relations agents for the beast, promoting its philosophies and its interests that conflict with God's. So, okay, it can be governments, but it can be, it's much broader. Verse 14, they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. War on the Lamb, this idea of war against God's people, war against the two witnesses, war against the woman and her offspring, Armageddon, it's there. And we are given a hint at what Armageddon entails. It's beast and kings versus Lamb and his people. And we're already told that the Lamb wins. The 144,000 are described as following the Lamb and are faithful to him, to the Lamb, in chapter 14. Verse 15, and the angel said to me, the waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. This comes from Psalm 144 and Isaiah 17. And the imagery here perhaps is that the world gives the prostitute her power. She is sitting atop all of these things. What is the base of her power? Peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. So the entirety of the world is giving the prostitute her power. You know, to say that this one particular church is giving the prostitute power, or there's particular government, or this particular business, or this social group, is wrong.
Or one guy.
It's the entire world.
Every person allows their own thinking.
Anyone who does not belong to the 144,000 who are sealed with God's seal, who are not God's servants, are giving power to the prostitute.
In mass.
And the 144,000
is not a literal 144,000, it's the entirety of all of God's servants. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire.
Yeah, we got the wrong one on the wrong side there.
She needs.
So, but the thing is with the 144,000, just, you know, imagery, and then multitude imagery is giving us the sense and the understanding that though you feel your few, the greatness is with you because you're with God. And that's what I think it's saying, is that you've got this 144,000 people in the scheme of the entire planet. Seems like nothing. Seems like, how could that even be? How could it be that God was only going to take that many? It's not necessarily that. It's that the Christians that already believe, that are reading Revelations under the understanding that they hold God true, are reading this knowing that they may be few, but they will prevail.
Well, and regarding 144,000, to us, we think of that many people and we think that's not very many people. We have the internet and the media and we see that many people just in Times Square for an ordinary celebration. But the people in the area surrounding Ephesus, if they were to think of 144,000 people, that would seem a tremendous multitude.
I don't know, Alexander's
no, it's
that.
A small number.
It's a small number. The ancient wars were thousands and thousands.
Perfect numbers.
Compared to some of the multitude that is not part of the 144,000.
10,000 times 10,000?
Yeah.
It's a small number.
It's an uncountable number versus a countable number.
Versus a lot of people, but still within
now,
a reasonable number.
Now, it would be inappropriate to then stretch that to say that only a fraction of the people through history are going to be saved.
Yes.
Because this is speaking to the emotion of its readers. It's not speaking about the number of people who will be saved versus who will not.
So I'm confused in 16. We finally got there. Is the beast turned on the prostitute? So now we have three.
It says evil turns on itself.
As we have discussed before, we are getting a hint, I think, at how the final judgment event is going to take place. God does not have to impose punitive measures because evil is going to destroy itself.
In other words, God's wrath isn't, I am.
Why is that? Because the priority of evil is always self. Uh-huh. I'm going to do whatever it takes to promote myself. And maybe it's that Babylon is suddenly becoming more prominent than the beast, and the beast doesn't like that. The kings who support the beast don't like that either.
And the prostitute discovers she's been used.
Well, I've got to ask it, because in classic Adventist theology, I don't remember 16. Where does classic Adventist theology put 16?
I do not know.
Maybe verse 16 is very prominent.
Because I don't remember the...
I don't remember it either.
I don't know, but let's see.
Well, we've always traditionally seen this is good, this is evil, and this will battle against this, and we will win. And we don't really notice the part about...
The detail.
Oh, God doesn't have to strike down the evil.
Well, I know the Ted Horns, there was two, and then there's one came up, but then they prevailed over
that. That's in Daniel.
Yeah. So, what happened
evil
to that?
Strikes down itself.
Usurp. What happened to the one that came up and spoke?
Well,
did the other prevail against it?
I don't know. It's part of Daniel, so we're...
We're not in Daniel.
No, we're not in Daniel.
Okay.
The idea of the prostitute's lovers turning against her comes from Old Testament prophecy, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Lamentations. There's another reference. Why are they burned? Why is she burned? Prostitutes, daughters of any priest, were to be burned by fire. This comes from Leviticus.
Well, to me, and maybe I'm totally wrong.
When they were babies, or
no, when they were when they.
Oh,
well, when a daughter of a priest became a prostitute.
Yeah, when she was caught as a prostitute.
Oh, when a regular woman would be stoned, but a daughter of a priest would
daughter
be
of a priest would be burned.
Lovely.
And maybe this also has an allusion going back to the rumor of Nero burning down Rome.
Is that past or future?
Past.
Past in this time.
It's maybe a warning to Rome about embracing the return of Nero that they expected.
Well, it seems to me that classically Revelation has done Catholic bashing. And 16 doesn't fit into that at all. And I think that's not only a bit inappropriate, I don't think it's good, healthy or whatever. But I think 16, and I think...
So you just kind of gloss over it?
It doesn't work. So,
17 gives the reason. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out His purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal part of the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Evil tries to twist good, but God is able to twist the twisting so that His purposes are accomplished.
Boy, lie to that one.
Historically, Revelation has been a book of watch out.
My will.
The terrible tribulations are going to come and persecution and all this stuff. But 16 and 17 actually turns it back around. It's not persecution is going to come on to the Christians. It's that those who rely on a false power are going to see the false power can't prevail.
Correct.
So actually, 16 and 17 kind of turns classic Revelation on its nose.
Yeah, and how long does this happen until the words of God are fulfilled? And in Revelation 15, it was said that the angels with the bowls and plagues, they are the end. This fulfills the judgment. Basically, I think what 16 and 17 is revealing is that evil is going to condemn and judge itself.
It's the fruition of evil. It's the whole universe is watching what happens to evil. And it destroys itself.
So it's an assurance to Christians that evil and oppression will self-destruct in the very near future.
That's not... Classic Adventism is...
It's not classic Christianity either.
It gets so bad, and they're persecuting the Christians so bad,
that God will rain down His fire and punish them.
Yeah, that's classic. And...
And
I'm hearing.
Look forward to the vengeance.
Yeah, God's going to take retribution on you.
And
guys.
We will get to watch.
But you're saying 16 and 17 don't support that.
I don't see it there.
So you're telling me that the end of the world may be different than what we I said baptism, you said Christianity. Maybe a total...
It may be very different. No, it's Revelation is not about predicting what's going to happen in the future. It's about the state that we will find ourselves in the future.
I believe that truth will stand...
Deprivation.
I believe the truth will stand on its own 2 feet. I believe that evil in itself is evil, therefore it can't work. And basically what you're saying is the end of the world is going to be because the world system collapses in on itself.
And I...
Not because God came down.
And I based that upon one of my foundational beliefs is that Jesus came to... The purpose of Jesus' atonement work was to reveal that violence does not work.
The second coming is going to come for judgment.
And so if Jesus on the cross revealed the consequences of violence for what it was and condemned violence by not reacting violently towards violence that was directed towards him, why would God react violently?
So rather than coming to judge and rain down fire, maybe he's simply coming to rescue the people who want to be with him from a situation.
He's coming. I think we misinterpret the coming part, because that's what we're hearing here, is that you already have had the come part. It's in here, and that's the only thing that you need to know. And there's no reason to say future or coming or waiting, because that's no longer happening. The Noel did that for you. Mary did that for you. She waited, she toiled, she wondered, she worked, and now there was.
And
that's it. So now everybody is going to go on and on and on about it, but that's the final thing that Revelation has revealed to you, that there's no coming, there is a came, and that all the rest of this stuff is what's happening because evil reigns, and we are not to indulge.
How about this? If the traditional...
Doesn't matter. Is what
if some of the things that we've traditionally looked forward to in the past do indeed happen, it will be relevant at that time.
Well,
if there is a literal coming of the clouds in the future, it will be relevant at that time, and it will make sense at that time. But it's not. But right now, the coming that we should look for is He's here.
Yeah, but
He's here with us. And
what Mark is saying is, early in Revelation, that we've always understood that the kings cried out for the rocks to fall on them because they realized that their system failed. We've always believed it, but we talk with double face. What happens if this earth, built on its false systems, starts to implode and starts to self-destruct? God's not coming to give vindication, because sin vindicates itself. God's coming down saying, oh my goodness, my loved ones are destroying themselves. He loves those people. And so rather than coming out of judgment, He's coming out of... He's crying this world destroying itself. He's not destroying the earth. He's crying that the earth destroyed itself.
Last verse. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. The woman is finally identified. She is the great city. She's also the great prostitute. The great city we know is Babylon from chapter 16:9. But the great city was also mentioned as Sodom and Egypt in chapter 11. So it encompasses all these things. It's a pattern. It's a pattern of behavior, a pattern of attitudes, principles and powers and systems. Babylon has power over the kings, but not really, because the kings, the seven heads and ten horns, actually belong to the beast. They are part of the beast. She thinks she has power over them. And eventually the kings return their power to the beast, which causes the prostitute to be killed. And all power ultimately originates from God. It's what the dragon and the beast and beasts, Babylon prostitute have done is they twist what is good. All sin is a perversion of what is good. Additional observations as we close here. It cannot be overemphasized that the entire chapter is symbolic. The imagery, as we've seen, is very fluid. Numbers are figurative. Chronology is ambiguous. Images, figures, and numbers, therefore, should not be pressed into literal applications. Although the angel tells John that he will be shown the judgment, that must wait until chapter 18, although we seem to be getting hints at how that judgment is going to play out. The Babylon kings and the beasts. Babylon is for John's readers the city of Rome, but it's the system. It includes guilds, religions, politics, etc., that promotes the imperial cult. It believes it is the one granting power to the kings. The people believe that they are the ones who grant, through their worship, power to the kings, to the emperor. The kings are the imperial cult. It's the seat of political, military, and religious powers and authority. It is able to kill Babylon. It can strip power away from her. The beast is the source of power and authority that is given to the kings and to Babylon. Its goal is to destroy the Lamb and his followers, and it seeks worship from all. And the question for today is then, how do we apply these things for us today? One of the main themes of this chapter is the comparison between false objects of worship, the cheap imitations versus the true. The beast, king's prostitute versus the true, the God, Jesus, and Lamb. The primary message that I see is that Christians don't have to be anxious about all the evil and oppression and all the sorrows, all the things that are happening in this world. It's not to say we shouldn't be concerned about them. We shouldn't take steps to alleviate those things, to have compassion, to empathy, but we should not be anxious about those things when they happen around us. Because evil will destroy themselves. Evil destroys itself. The principles and systems of the world cannot succeed. God's principles always overcome. Another way to say it is, love always wins.
That is not a normal way of reading Revelation. Revelation has always been God's judgment on man, but you're saying here is, truth will stand on its own two feet, bad will destroy yourself.